That's the master of the screaming trumpet, John Faddis, with Into the Faddisphere, the title track from the CD released in 1989. Lee Rosnes on piano, Phil Bauer on bass, and Ralph Peterson Jr. on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It is Friday, May the 30th, and you are cordially invited to free your mind. What's your opinion on the zillions of news stories and issues and developments that we've witnessed this past week? What would you like us to consider? 888-874-4888 is a number to call to get things started. You should know, of course, by now that General Shinseki, who was, of course, the U.S. Veteran Affairs Secretary, has tendered his resignation in the aftermath of this scandal related to the abysmal medical services, I should say, not just delivered, but not delivered to veterans. And the president has accepted his resignation and named his deputy, Sloan Gibson, to carry on as the interim head of the Veterans Administration. Some thoughts about that. It's a very sad thing. But at the same time, you know, that kind of resolute action by the president is the same kind of resolute action that voters ought to have. When the president fails to deliver, that's what you do. You fire him. You just take him out of the way and get somebody else in who will pay attention to your specific concerns. And we have the Clippers, purchased for $12 million, and now about to be purchased for $2 billion. Some thoughts about that, too. But this is your day, so let's hear what you have to say. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hello, wonderful Utrecht.
Hello, Harvey. Wonderful Harvey.
I always look forward to Free for All Friday on your show. It's a great event, as far as I'm concerned. Well, I'd like to talk about one of the most important things, water, our freshwater resources. And unfortunately, you know, especially here in California, we have the drought, that these things remain front page. You know, it's the most important thing. If we don't have water, then we don't have water is life. And so it's that important. And it turns out that that coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear power plants are second only to agriculture in their daily consumption of our freshwater resources. And we really, this is getting kind of scary, especially with fracking, you know, where they poison, not only do they use millions of gallons of water per frack, but they poison the, they pump the poisons that they use for fracking back down into the earth and polluting the freshwater aquifers. I mean, we are really destroying ourselves from within here. And I say that we have the technology that doesn't use water to make electricity, like photovoltaic, that's light to electricity, thermoelectric, heat to electricity, and piezoelectric, that's pressure to electricity. Once manufactured, they don't use any water over, like photovoltaics, they can go for 50 years, but they're often warranted for about 25 years. The silicon solar cells. So I want to thank President Obama for putting solar panels on the roof house, thereby reducing the need for as much water to power the White House. And at the same time, there's like about half a million federal buildings out there, and I would say, you know, cover the rooftops as fast as possible, so that these federal buildings aren't using water by using coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear. They're using water to produce electricity. And also plug the federal fleet of cars into the rooftops on federal buildings. And this would, again, you know, because gasoline plants use a lot of, you know, to the petroleum to make gasoline. They take a lot of water in these plants. So it's just a matter of changing over with the technology that we already have, as our climate destabilization changes everything and moving toward a more secure freshwater future, because the way we're running the game right now, it's really we're hurting ourselves, we're hurting the planet, and it's all for short-term profit. But the thing is that we have the technology. It's not that we don't have it to move away from all that. And I'm calling for a new reinvestment in a clean energy future, because our freshwater resources depend on it.
Very sound position, Harvey. Thank you so much for starting us off today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. From Dallas, it's Sarah.
Hello, Hugh.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Greetings to you, your trees, and greetings to the PRN audience.
Thank you, and same to you.
Yes, ma'am. I know I'm going to start off by wishing everyone an enjoyable weekend, and I hope that you all go out and have some fun. Utrees, I must commend you on your program for yesterday that you did with the now ancestor, Maya Angelou. It was very, very apropos, and I am so glad that you said what you did about her, because I've been reading on the internet. And now I'm seeing that people are starting, you know, they can't wait for this woman to make her ascendancy to the ancestral realm. They are starting to dig into her past and talk about her being a madam and all of this nonsense. Well, you know, it is just, they have a way of trashing people when they die and not give people the proper respect that it is due. Not as if the woman ever hid her past or did not say what she have done, but what relevance is it now to start bringing this information up now? You know, it's just about, you know, it just seems about with black people that when our people die, they always have to go digging into the frameworks to find the most nasty things that they can find about them. They can't say to their faces when they're alive, but they wait until they transition, and then everybody wants to come and rip them apart when the dead can't defend themselves. But I'm digressing slightly. On the topic, Utrecht, that you were speaking about with politics and these politicians, now, those three from Florida, those three black congressional reps from Florida that needs to be thrown out of office, because I was reading that piece that Glenn Ford published about them and how they're trying to impose the CBC, Congressional Black Caucus, is trying to impose sanctions on Venezuela. Now, here these clowns are, these three. They can't do nothing for Haiti. You've been pushing all along, telling this Frederica Person and Alcee Hastings and all of them down in Florida what they need to do for the Haitian people who have family here, who needs to get them over here so that they can get the things that they need to have done. They can't do that, but here they're going to go and let their Zionist backers push them, because we know they have a very large contingency of Venezuelans down in the South Florida area. Push them and tell them to go ahead and let the U.S. impose sanctions against Maduro's government in Venezuela. This is the idiocy that we see here, where you've seen that I've said before, the horse has left the barn has been burnt down, and you have no other choice but to take these horses out and shoot them or put them out their doggone misery. That's the only choice that you have, is to put them out of their misery, because you have a bunch of wild stallions just running around here tearing up stuff. And as you said, when elephants fight, only the grass is the only ones who end up getting to suffer the trampled grass. And this is what we have on our hands with these people here. They don't represent us. They represent corporate interests and other foreign interests that does not have the best interests of our people at stake. What does it have to do with what you're supposed to be doing to represent the Congressional Black Caucus and black people's interests? Your more interest should be more in what's going on in Haiti, and to get these people up here who has family and could use the assistance from being down there with the cholera and everything that's going on with those people to get them the help that they need. But no, you're going after the money, and you're going after what your paid financiers is telling you that you need to do. These people don't represent us. And it's the same thing you do.
The community has to move in a far more assertive way, and that's what I mean. When you're stuck with this kind of leadership, you don't get anything done. And the program you referenced is one that we've been talking about, family reunification. It had already been approved. All that just needs to happen is that the president should say, yes, let's get on with this thing. It has been approved by a bipartisan vote that everybody had said before that this is what needs to be done to alleviate the suffering, and it still isn't done. But you know, until people make that decision, we get the leadership we deserve, and we get the leadership we deserve, whether by our action or by inaction.
But you see, this is the type of thing that you see that these people that these elect black representatives, because I'm on the black ones this time, because these are the ones who always like to run out here and do these silly nonsense things in order to get publicity or to get easy victories. Like they use these things here for election season coming up. Are they going to pull these things, you know, like the saying goes, pick these low-hanging fruits to go out here to try and show the people, oh, you see, we out here, we doing something, we're trying to do this and we're trying to do that. Which brings me back to another case here dealing with foreign policy and this president and what is going on here in Nigeria. Now, he comes up with $5 billion to give over there to help to train these people here to go and find these girls. You see, Eutresa said the same thing last week, and people thought that I was off my meds and I was going on a rant when I was talking about what was going on with last week and these girls.
Off your meds?
That's what they thought, but no, dear. I'm not on any medication. I get exhilaration when I go off like this sometimes, but I'm going to calm down. But this situation, Eutresa, that I said before, this is the point of reference that they had to this situation with the girls, and I'm very sorry about the girls and the appearance involved in this. But this was the foothold that the public need. All they needed for somebody to say, okay, y'all need to do something, you know, like we always do. You hear this stuff happening in Ukraine with Victoria Nuland calling a hot mic saying about the $5 billion that she gave the rebels in the Ukraine to topple that government. Now you keep hearing the same $5 billion figures being given out here in the U.S. to go into Africa to solidify this, what's going on in the African continent to recolonize it. This is going to be disastrous, Eutresa. As I said before, it's going to be a disastrous situation that's going to happen, because all you are seeing now is the colonial powers, headlined by the United States as the enforcement wing, coming back here into the continent at full blast, and now they're going to train these killers, because this is going to be the same thing, Eutresa. We saw what happened in these Latin American countries with the death squads and everything else that we had went on through with the 80s, with the Contras and all of that. It's going to be the same thing on the continent, where black people are being trained to take out other black people, topple governments, kill people, and do all of that. It's going to be on a more ramped-up scale on the African continent.
Now,
this is exactly what's going to happen.
Question to you. Question
yes,
to you.
Ma'am.
What is the position, the official position of the concerned authorities, the African Union, the so-called Congressional Black Caucus? We have an African, supposedly an African-American president. These are the issues that we need to raise. What is going on? How could all of this be going on without vocal participation by the concerned, or you could think of the authorities and organizations that should be concerned about this? And I raise it in the context of course, of the wealthy. I'm not surprised. I won't be surprised if we find out that the wealthy, the folks in Nigeria have just been paying off these folks and say, listen, you could go ahead, you know, you do what you need to do and kill off as many people as you wish. Just don't blow up our oil fields and don't damage our wealth-generating projects. So we have a decided silence here, and that is very troubling, because in the end, that too, and it is just another level, it is just another level of what we have been living with all along, which is in the middle of the fight, very, very important actors are just absent or silent. We don't hear anything from them. And then that leaves wide open the door for all these things that you're talking about to happen without criticism, without opposition. This is what happens. The people who are vital to the process are absent by their own volition, and they leave it, you know, let chaos rule. And then when it happens, then people say, well, look what happened. Well, of course,
you're
seeing it. You see what I mean? So that's exactly the piece we have to consider as well. Thank you so much.
Eutrice, what I'm going to say, quickly make a suggestion to you. If you can, please, I sent you an email about, you know, potential guests. Glenn Ford is also on this network. He does his program, him and Molly Bailey. If you could, Miss Nellie Bailey, if you can please try and get him on the program, you know, to do an interview with him, it would greatly appreciate and shed some light, because I've read several of his writings for years. He's a well-researched journalist such as yourself. So please see if you could get the brother on the show, and he would perhaps shed another side of the light on this conflict that's going on with the United States government and their empire building and sealing that they are doing.
I certainly take that under advisement. Here's what I'm really interested in. I'm interested in the African vision. What is the vision from Africa about African affairs?
Exactly. It has to be their vision and not the American, not the blacks, because I've heard too many educated blacks, you trees, talking about U.S. troops going in there on the ground, and yes, they need to go in there and they need to do things. And you know, some respectable blacks don't even want to call their names, that they're all for this man, for the United States being the strong arm and with the big feet stomping all over the globe. And it just goes to show you, Treece, which once again, I come back to Dr. Amos Wilson's book, Blueprint for Black Power, and he said the same thing about when Malcolm X before him said the same thing, when the white supremacists are going to put a black face on it, and that is what they have done. They put a black face on their white supremacy, so black people are sitting back. It has taken the power out of them. It has taken the bite from them, and they've all sit back there, and their mouth is shut, and they've let this man, because all Barack Obama is doing, he's carrying on the policy from all of the other administration. He is just taking it a little bit further. That's all he is doing.
Well, we also have the tendency, and this is one of the things that needs to be corrected, the tendency in or among the African-American intellectual community to also act superior to everybody else and knowing exactly what ought to happen. So I'm interested really in hearing the voices of Africa on this situation. And if I'm hearing from African Americans on it, I want to know what it is that, what kind of influence are they prepared to flex as, you know, part of the coordinated effort in responding to a huge crisis on the continent. Thanks for your call today.
You're welcome, Eutrice.
Thank you. And have a great weekend, sir. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Eutrice, how you doing?
Fine, thank you, Henry. How are you?
I'm doing good. This is something that just actually recently came in. I guess Obama decided to fire Shinzicki for the veteran debacle that's been happening actually for decades now.
Yes.
And it's interesting because the way he fired this guy is sort of like he just got out there and just started, I guess he just got to kind of like rip this guy apart. So I'm saying to myself, like, wait a minute. Don't you got other cabinet members that you can actually let go, you know, for probably crimes that's egregious to what
now, who would those be, Henry?
Well, let's start with one, Eric Holder, and how he basically just refused to prosecute any of the guys in the Bush administration that dealt with the Wall Street collapse. And my favorite guy, Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan.
That's my favorite, too.
But, yeah, I'm sitting here like, you got guys on your cabinet that you should have fired a long time ago. But I don't know. I mean, maybe, you know, I hate to think about it, but this guy is he's got a lot of people around him that I don't know if he purposely put them there or if it's just something that he just gets the wrong people all the time. And especially, you know, and I've called you before about Arne Duncan and how that was just like a total shocker when he announced that. But obviously we all know because he's
you know, Obama's basketball buddy. And the way he has decimated education in this country in his short time there, it's just amazing, you know? It's just really amazing.
In a way, as one of the greatest weaknesses of this president, and he is weak in this respect, is that, number one, I think that the whole idea of getting elected in the first instance, you know, he was surrounded by people who had a vested interest in him, but not really as a leader, but as a means toward their ascendancy and to their strategic placement wherever it is they wanted to land. So they had a vested interest in his election. He might have mistaken that as support. when he came in, if this were to be truly a transformative president, this man would have studied every single appointment to the finest degree, and to get the exact person to deal with the plethora of problems that would have to be tackled in order to have a successful administration based on the mandate that he got from such a wide swath of people. You don't make political appointments. You choose people who are gonna come in there and get things done. You are at war. You know, your job is within X number of years or days, you have to produce Y results. You know, you are absolutely results-oriented. But this president is weak. And he has made appointments that other interests have a vested interest in. People put in these high places, and that's why he made these appointments. How else do you explain, how could Hillary Clinton possibly have been Secretary of State? She's not qualified on any level, not academically, not experientially, in no way. The woman doesn't even speak a foreign language.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing about it. It's like all his appointments are connected with Clinton, connected with Bush, with the first Bush. And it's
so
like,
he's just rehashing
guys over and over.
This president is a tweaker. That's all he's going to do. The best you could expect of Barack Obama is he'll tweak. He'll turn the screw about 3 degrees, and he would consider that a fix. Well, because he's being told what to do. When you come in, and you know that Veterans Affairs, that's a huge, it's been a festering sore for decades. And you are choosing a person and who's been on the job. And, you know, I'm sure General Shinseki was a very nice, everybody speaks very highly of him, a man of great integrity and honor and so forth, and he is a veteran, and there's much to respect there. But does that mean that he was the right guy for the job?
Yeah, and I guess according to Obama, he wasn't. And just look, let's just say, I'm not going to put the burden of the blame on him, because when he got appointed, a lot of this stuff was going on for decades. I remember my father, who's a Vietnam veteran, you know, fighting for his benefits, you know, for years. I mean, just like literally years. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, but, you know, if you make an appointment because, number one, you have an Asian in your cabinet, and that counts for the bulk of the grade to qualify him for that position, as opposed to you have somebody who is going to get in there and tear this thing apart and find out where the problems are and get them fixed in quick, fast, and in a hurry. That's, you need a bulldog. You need somebody who understands that the mandate here is to fix a broken system. By the time anybody is considered for a position, just like any CEO, if you're hiring, let's say, somebody to head up a division within your company or something, you want to know what skills they have and to match the problems that you expect them to deal with. You see, when you're operating in this fog that Barack Obama seems to have been operating in, and by the way, his conduct is very, very, how should I say, it's really not very, very pleasant to observe how he cannibalizes his people. First you choose them, you bring them in, and then you tear them up. I mean, what kind of stuff do you do that, you know, all, and you bring them in at the behest of somebody, and you tear them up at the behest of somebody. You make no independent calls, because that's his whole thing. He does not have a history of committing himself, you know, just himself, me, I, Barack Obama. This is the guy I want on my team, and this is what we're going to do, because he's the... This woman is these are the best people, and we're going to tackle this. You have a bunch of marauders. Everybody's doing their own thing. They're all looking after their own political careers or their political afterlife. They're there racking up points and notches on their belt to command great speaking fees and books and other engagements. That's what you have. You have entrepreneurs. Everybody practically on Barack Obama's team is an entrepreneur.
I will agree to you to a degree, because for some reason or another, he is basically beholden to Arne Duncan for some reason or another. He will not criticize him. He will not rip him apart or anything, despite everybody else in the education field ripping him apart for what he has done to education in this country. So he's the exception. I agree with you on the other one, but he is basically the exception. I don't know what he has on Obama, why he still has his job, and it is just sad that, you know, this guy is still there, and, you know, other people in his cabinet members still there. But, you know, the thing about the Obama election that I think people should have had the light bulb on was, you know, it doesn't matter what president you have in there, because the thing is that they will all be beholden to the elite, which, you know, unfortunately runs the government. And
including the president. And this is the woeful thing about Barack Obama's presidency. It's the greatest tragedy of it. Here is a guy, if ever there was a president in recent memory who has actually been given a mandate, I mean, incredible, enthusiastic support by a wide spectrum of people. That should be, and it should continue to be, the currency that he operates with, that he should have no fear about making decisions, because his folks, he's doing the bidding of all of these millions and millions of people, and they will back him. But of course, he's a coward. So he started out this political career in service to other interests. He has been faithful about it, which is what, again, explains all these Clinton holdovers that he has with him now, and who are now controlling Office of Management and Budget and the Federal Reserve, and all these Clintonites surrounding him in preparation for when Hillary takes her rightful and, you know, God-ordained post as President of the United States. So this is what we have. We have a coward as a president, a guy who is terrified of affirming and believing in the power that was imbued in him with this incredible vote, an overwhelming groundswell of support that should always be the one thing that he should keep in mind when he makes decisions, that he has nothing else to fear. But of course, he's a fearful guy, and he's an entrepreneur too. He's one of the entrepreneurs in his own administration.
And also, Treece, the reason why he is not afraid of the black vote is because they're going to vote for him anyway, despite the fact that most of his policies have been against black people.
Black folks are voting for him. Of course, they identify with him ethnically, but they're voting for him also because they're faithful, ridiculously and implausibly and illogically faithful to the Democratic Party. For what reason, I don't know.
Oh, my God.
So he's a twofer. He's a brother and he's a Democrat. And man, oh man, what reason, what incentive to vote for him?
Oh my God. Yeah, I can't explain that.
Thank you, Henry. Have
Thank
a great
you.
Weekend in Chicago.
You too.
From Baltimore, it's Green on the air.
Hello, Eutrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you doing?
Good. You know, when I call, I don't tell the person who answers the phone that I'm from Baltimore, but you always remember.
Yes.
No, I admire your memory.
Thanks. It's working so far.
You know,
can't vouch for it another couple of years from now, but so far it's hanging in here with me.
Well, no, you exercise your mind, and so I think you'll stay agile for a long, long time. You know, some of us in Baltimore refer to Baltimore City as Tubman City, you know, in honor of Harriet Tubman, who resided for a while in Baltimore. But that's not really why. The reason I called was, often when I call, it's in response to something that you've said or something that one of your callers have said. And I remember one time I called in because you and a few other people had asked the question, why don't black people do the things that improve their position? And I was talking about how it's hard for people to go against that thing that they feel validates them. And many of us feel validated by, being born in the United States or living in the United States. And perhaps because I have two of the rules I have for myself is to never divorce myself from my people. If, whether we're demonstrating our best or our worst, they're still my people. And also I refuse to excuse anyone's bad behavior, which includes the bad behavior of white people. So immediately after my call, Clara called, and she said she didn't get what I was saying, but people like me are the problem. Well, I think that she thought that I feel validated by being in America. But I was, delighted at her further comment that people like me are the problem. And those of us who do feel validated by being American are the problem or part of the problem. Now, I would be hypocritical, I think, and this goes to DX's call last week about what group I belong to. I have previously defined myself on your show as an African. I'm not an American. And people who know me know that if someone calls me an American, I take it as a deliberate insult. I'm an African. As far as where I was born or where I lived, I can be called an American African, but I'm validated by the group that I belong to, which I believe is the greatest group, the greatest people who ever walked this planet.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yes, ma'am.
I mean, if you're going to be offended because people in a society, we are schooled to relate to each other in a particular way, how are people supposed to know what would what label, for lack of a better term, applies to you, and therefore they should know that, to approach you differently?
Well, that's simple. I tell them, no, I'm not an African-American. I am an African. If you want to be technical about where I was born or where I live, you can call me an American African. But, it's simple to tell people, who we are. you know, it's about self-definition. The greatest, okay. You know, also, I never called myself a reformed white supremacist. I say that I am a recovering white supremacist. Because as you said, white supremacy is a system. It's a system that's been spread worldwide. And I mentioned before a book that I would recommend for everyone to read, and that's Dr. Francis Cress Welsing's The ISIS Papers, The Keys to the Colors, where she provides the best working definition of racism that I've come across through the 7 decades that I've lived in. So, and as a system, everything that we come into contact with teaches and promotes white supremacy. We're fed white supremacy from the womb. Since we're indoctrinated from the time that we have any understanding, and even before that, it's impossible for anyone to escape being a white supremacist. This is why I've never said that all racists are white. Black people, we are indoctrinated to be racist too, because we don't care too much for black. A good example of that is the number of our women who spend the fortune making another group wealthy by trying to have hair that looks like the Supreme group's hair. And the brothers aren't off the hook because we encourage it. Why do we do that? Because we've been indoctrinated to feel that the characteristics, as well as everything else about the Supreme group, is superior to us.
This is what obtains all over the world, where you have
ma'am,
dominant groups and you have groups that are dominated. This is the nature of the relationship. It is psychological, deeply psychological. And
exactly.
It is also part, and that, by the way, is used in a very proficient way to create the new society that the dominant group wants. If everybody agrees that the dominant group is the standard, and that would include those people who are dominated, if everybody is on the same page with it, it makes life so much easier because, you know, things are under control. So you have uniformity of thought and you have uniformity of action. So it is understandable. This is not unique at all to the United States, not at all. Thanks, Doug Green, for your call today.
This is what I'm saying. It's a worldwide
system. You have to hurry
system.
Because we have a lot of folks waiting.
But Europeans being the strongest people on the planet right now, we can't deny that, they have the ability to control information around the world. And
I would take issue with that. They're not the strongest people at all. Not by any means. I would take issue with that. DX, you're on the air from L.A.
Yes, hello, Trees. How are you?
Huh? Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks a lot. I had called in originally to say something else, but you guys have been having so many good conversations this morning. First, I wanted to just touch on Green's call of a minute ago, or right before me. I in no way, when I called last week, meant any kind of disrespect toward him, and if I offended him, I apologize. I did not. The only statement that I had an issue with that he stated when he called previous times was that it's either really hard or impossible to prove racism when he started going down that track. Now, and then when I called last week, we got into systematic racism versus individual racism. So that was the point that I was talking about. I would agree with much of what he just said, that we are all indoctrinated into a system that is everything that's white is good, or most everything, and everything that's black tends to be bad or something like that. And he's right about black women. They, you know, want the straight hair and all this other stuff. But I think that's more of a warped psyche from the situation what we grew up in. And I don't believe that I would classify them as racist against their own race. I think it's just conditioning. So in order to give some other people some more time, I'm just going to leave that at that. And then I'll just go to what you guys were talking about as far as Mr. Obama or President Obama. I would disagree with you on the fact that he's a coward. I think when he, at this point, I don't believe he's a coward. I believe when he first got in there the first year or so, he was very scared. He was put upon by all the wrong people, quote unquote wrong people. And that's why he threw people under the bus like Van Jones and was going to throw Shirley Sherrod under the bus, but he did. And then she defended herself. And this is why he does it, at first because he was scared. I believe at this point, though, he's not scared anymore. He's not a coward anymore. This is all deliberate. He's a corporately owned president, just even more than George W. Bush was, I believe. So I don't think this comes out of fear. I think this comes out of whoever his advisors who are corporately connected tell him to get rid of, he's going to do it. Just so happens that his corporate advisors and of course, the corporations involved in charter schools and private schools like Arne Duncan, and because he's all for that. He's all on their side. So he just does what his corporate masters tell him to do. I'm speaking about President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's how I analyze it. I do not believe he's a coward in any way. This is the same thing about him closing Guantanamo. Military-industrial complex doesn't want it. All these companies making all this money off of the security and imprisoning people don't want that. So they're keeping him from doing it because he's a corporate man. He's a yes man. Whatever they want, he's going to do. Whatever the people want, he's not going to even bother with it because he doesn't care at this point anyway, because he doesn't need to get reelected. And that's why he says these things that sound a little progressive, and what he wants to do, and then what he plans on fighting for doing, but he never actually does it or fights for doing it.
You see, that's been consistent with his political history. I mean, most of his voting record, even in Illinois as a state senator, was neither yes nor no votes.
Right.
They were simply present votes.
Present, right, exactly.
Okay, so here's a person who has a psychological mindset that he's always giving himself an exit. You know, you can't nail him to anything that would suggest that you have a make on his convictions. You know, he's a person who can't be read that way. But there's an interesting turn that he has taken, and it is, I think, psychologically, he has come to terms with the fact that he will never, ever get anything else done. So he has come to terms with himself as simply a guy with a couple of years left on the highest office of the country. And he's going to try and make the best of it. But from the word go, this man facilitated all these. Sorry, go ahead.
I would disagree with you slightly there. I don't think he's made resolute in his mind or come to a conclusion in his mind that he's not going to get anything else accomplished. I think he's come to the conclusion in his mind that he wants to be in the in crowd in crowd when he's out of office. He wants to be another Bill Clinton and be even richer and more popular than Bill Clinton. But
he's an entrepreneurial. I described him as an entrepreneurial president. You know, you have to look at the fact that both he and Michelle Obama just gave up their law licenses.
Right.
Many years ago, which is unusual.
Mm-hmm.
It means that they see themselves right. as entrepreneurs. They're going to make money, and it's
right.
not going to be with this silly business of law. They now have higher hopes. But Obama essentially was a shill. He's a guy right. with a nice face. Great public relations, great marketing person. He ignited, he just exploded on the political scene and it fired up the imaginations of people and got, it was a magical thing to observe.
Right. But as you indicated, or you said a few minutes ago, you've never been able to pin him down on anything, and he does that deliberately, especially when he was in Illinois in the Senate and then in the Senate for the United States, because he knew he had ambitions of being in the White House. So you're not going to pin him down on anything. And I don't know if you remember during the 2008 election, he was in the primary against Hillary Clinton, and it came out that one of his main people had told somebody at, I don't remember the corporation or the entity they told, but they told him, oh, he's just saying that. Just don't worry about that. He's not going to do that. See, this is the type of double dealing he's been doing all the time, and he's very slick at it. Do you remember the incident I'm referring to where they came out and said that he had told some industry person that don't worry about that. That's just talk. He's not going to do that. You remember that?
I vaguely recall it. Here's
right.
the thing, and this is why I use the word coward. If you are weak in the knees, let's just say, or you're hesitating because there is enormous, this is an enormous task to take on. It's one thing to say you're running and then look, you won and you won big.
Right.
And now you're going to have to deliver because it's the masses of people who are going to be looking to you. You already know that small group that controls you, they're there.
Right.
The question is, how do you satisfy the demands of the masses of people? Okay. If you're shivering in the knees because it's a daunting task, the
right.
one thing you want to do is at least suggest to the small group that controls you, that you have something also as a backup. You have the will and the approval of the people. You do something. You give them something. You know, it's like, the politicians who steal everything. No,
right.
You can steal 95%. Give 5% to the people. You know what I mean? It lets them know that, well, at least we might have been an afterthought, but at least we have 5%. But
well,
this man is just the psychological resistance to making a decision that he fully owns. There is a problem there. He can't do it.
Yeah, Yatrice, the last thing I wanted to say is that I can't stand to hear this man talk anymore. I just can't stand it because he lies 15 times in a paragraph, in a sentence. And he's talking the other night, and I happened to catch some of the speech at West Point or wherever it was, and he's talking about how America, we're not going to hesitate to use international this and that to make sure people obey international law, and we're going to put pressure, we're going to do it. It's all BS at this point. And it's so annoying.
Yeah, because look at Snowden. Here's a guy who has yet to be indicted. Do you know there's no indictment of Snowden?
Mm-hmm.
With all this stuff, he's a traitor and he's all, well, where's the indictment? There is no indictment. So, yes. You know, you talk as, you know, the great philosopher James Brown said, you're talking loud and saying nothing.
Exactly. And that's what I mean, because he talks all the talks, but never does anything.
Right. You edit the Harvard Law Review, but there is no article, there's no nothing there with your name on it that said that you have written right. a legal tome of any sort. There's
just
nothing
like
there.
Senate.
The man who was not there.
Just like in the Senate.
That's the problem that we have. And this is what is so sad, because, you know, this was what we experienced in New York City under David Dinkins. Here was a man who, again, in a parallel way, came to power as the first African-American mayor of the city of New York. It was a big deal. It was quite a feat.
Right.
And the minute he got in, he just absolutely did nothing. And all that people could remember, for the most part, about David Dinkins' time in office was that he dressed well.
But, Patrice, how can we get this across to our people, to black people, that still support him? I mean, I try to tell people, and these are people whose situations are not getting better. They're getting worse. They're struggling a little, and they're, you know, losing jobs and doing this and doing that. And because of this guy's inaction or his deliberate support of Duncan's actions and things like that, these people still don't want to hear that this is not their guy.
It is a hard thing, because they have to deal with something that I think on an emotional and psychological level, it's very hard for people to deal with the truth of betrayal and failure when your trust is absolutely trampled by somebody. Basically, you're conned. You know, you've been punked.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody, it's not a pleasant thing to actually admit that all these hopes and dreams and all this energy that was invested, it was basically in a person who can't stand up to the job and won't make a decision to place his faith, not even the smallest iota of faith, in the overwhelming investment people made in him, and say, look, I could move on this because this is what the folks want, and I know if I do that, they'll back me up.
I don't think he's a coward. I think he's just going for the dough. I don't think he's a coward. I don't think he's scared at all. I think he's
No, it speaks of a certain timidity, because it is consistent. He may be going for the dough. A lot of politicians do. So in that sense, it's not an unusual experience in the world of politics that would be one of the things that particular politician has. But it speaks to a consistent character problem that you find such great comfort in being, a gelatinous mass. Nobody knows exactly what it is. You're neither left nor right. You're neither upside or downside. Nobody knows who you are. Nobody can tell what it is that you actually are committed to.
Pathological liar.
I'm sorry?
I said that's pathological. He's a pathological liar.
But that has worked for him, and that's the thing. If you look at the profile, this has worked for him,
mm-hmm.
because you get the sense that even he is afraid. If people really knew that I am terrified about the situation, I mean, I have to carry this thing off.
Mm-hmm.
And you see these instances where you expect a particular kind of response, and this president just does it. It flies over his head. I mean, I listened shortly after El Cinco de Mayo. I happened to be coursing through C-SPAN, and guess what? At the White House, the president starts off. Now, there are all these people there gathered because he is observing Cinco de Mayo, okay, and is using this as a backdrop to talk about immigration. And how does he start off? He starts off talking about the drinks, and he starts off, you know, it's going to be great music and fantastic drinks, and you know, this, it's almost infantile. And it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't jive at all with a person who says, or who professes to have a sense of history, that he's a, you know, he's a student of history, that he's, you know, he has a, an intellectual side and so forth. You just, these things just don't compute.
Right. Or,
you know, they just don't add up. So what we see, and this is what I mean by the cowardice of the president, and by that I mean the unwillingness or the incapacity to actually honor the faith that people have in him with a reciprocal faith that they will back him up when he moves in their interests. That's cowardice. That's political cowardice. And it is certainly not the kind of cowardice you expect at the level of president. You know, that's for when people are running for dog catcher and cat catcher and that kind of thing, and they're testing out their political wings. But when you reach the level of president of the United States, you have to move beyond that. Thanks so much for your call, DX. Thank you, Harvey, Sarah, Green, Henry from Chicago, DX from LA. Thank you all. And this from Steve Kruger. Obama's mandate from the voters has no meaning to him, as he does not represent the people. He works for his contributors. You pay, you play. Have a great weekend. See you on Monday.